Support for Strange Fruit comes from Caperton Realty, a locally owned and operated real estate company committed to helping clients find their ideal home in Louisville and surrounding areas. Families and homes, each designed differently. Realtors and listings at CapertonRealty.com.
Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit by WFPL.
Welcome back to listeners. So Black History Month is over, but yes, it is Women's History Month.
It is.
And we are excited about that. And that's why I'm really excited, in particular for two of our guests, two really, really wonderful Black women who are going to share some amazing stuff with us. But Doc, so one of the hottest movies, I guess, over the past, you know, couple, it's like a franchise, right? Mm-hmm. Of course, not The Hunger Games, which is my favorite because of Jennifer Lawrence, but also the whole like 50 Shades of Grey situation, right?
And it's so terrible.
It is very terrible. You know, most people who are within the community of BDSM and those kinds of things say that it's really a problematic movie. And then of course Lucy said the book is trash, right? Lucy read the book, our friend Lucy Brooks, and said the book is poorly written.
Well, she said it was poorly edited in the sense that there were a lot of grammatical errors, typos, okay, so on and so forth.
But nonetheless, it's got like modern white America talking all about BDSM and such like that. But I think we want to get to like the heart of what is it like for someone, especially a person of color who works within domination and BDSM and those kinds of things. And so, listeners, please welcome to the show, Mistress Velvet.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing so good. How are y'all?
Good. We are super excited to talk to you today. You have been described as the dominatrix with a syllabus. You are a Black woman who assigns, apparently, Black feminist theory to your clients who are overwhelmingly white cisgender men. First of all, tell us a bit about, for people who don't know, what is BDSM? If they maybe only seen, 50 Shades of Grey, or maybe they've only seen it like kind of satirized. Mm-hmm. What is BDSM in particular, and how is it different from maybe other forms of kink, if you will?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so BDSM, all of the letters stand for different things like bondage and discipline, sadomasochism. So it's just like a really kinky space to try a lot of new things. And I think for me, a big core of BDSM is that there is a lot of power dynamics. So you'll hear words, I hear in BDSM spaces, words being thrown around like tops and bottoms and slaves. I use things like that, or just like allowing us to explore maybe our submissive sides and our dominant sides, allowing us to explore pain in a pleasurable way, allowing us to explore a lot of different things outside of vanilla missionary hetero sex that is like largely white. So I think BDSM is a lot of different things to a lot of different people, but it is not vanilla.
Oh, yes. I love it.
Yes, we live. So how did you get your start in being a dom? Like, how did you become Mistress Velvet?
Yeah, I mean, so it was really like I had gotten into the graduate program that I wanted to do, which is in women's and gender studies. And so when I got into that, which was a kind of a long, complicated journey for me, because as a daughter of immigrant parents and an immigrant myself, I was supposed to go to med school, and I turned that down. My parents were really upset, and they had me on this other trajectory, and so I applied to this program secretly and was like, if I get into this master's program, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to change my life around, and it's going to be kind of hectic with my family, but it's going to make me happy. So I got in. I celebrated by like traveling and backpacking through Central America and came back that summer, you know, going to start grad school in a few months, and was like, I had a friend that had been a dom for a while. I asked her lots of questions about it. It seemed really empowering. And I was like, I want to get to know myself in this kind of way. And so I decided to start exploring and becoming a dom.
No, but apparently your first foray did not go all that well. I guess maybe your first client questioned if this you were cut out for this. Tell us about that story.
Yeah, oh, poor guy. He was this, I found him on like Backpage, you know, so I was like very new dom, and I was like, I don't know how to find clients. I'm going to look for people that are posting about wanting to be submissive. And so I found him. Wonderful guy, lived in the town that I lived in. He like really set me up. He like gave me a couple hundred dollars and was like, get yourself some clothes, get yourself in the aesthetic that you want to get into, buy some paddles and things that you think you could use. And he would talk me through a lot of things that he was interested in. Like, he was really into a lot of pain. And considering that he was like a white man, very tall, like over 6 feet and very built.
Yes.
So I think that he was having a lot of problems in his like kind of vanilla relationship sexually, where he's like, I have these partners, and then I tell them about, like, I want to be beaten or have these things happen to me, mainly pain, and they don't want to do it because of, like, kind of the masculinity imposed upon him. And so I'm like, oh, yeah, I got you. Don't worry. Except it turns out I didn't, because I remember the first day I had to slap him in the face. I was like, I hit him kind of soft, and it was like, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. Are you okay? And he's looking at me like, I'm literally paying you for this. And so it was kind of that dynamic for like 3 months. Like, he was very patient with me. And after 3 months, he was like, you're awesome, but like, this is not working. You will not be a dom. You do not know how to do this. And I like a challenge. So I was like, you know what? This white guy said I can't do this. I'm going to show him. Except, yeah. I've never actually seen him again and told him that I'm now a dom.
Well, I'm sure he's seen you either on Huffington Post or he's seen you on Sluttis. He's seen you because you're making headlines everywhere. So I think that's really awesome.
Yes. And so what, after you got, you know, your footing and grounding and being a dom, you decided to start to introduce feminist theory, in particular Black feminist theory, with your clientele. Yes. Tell us a little bit about why you started introducing theory. You've said it's cathartic for you, and how is the clientele reacting to it?
Okay, so it really started with, you know, it wasn't, like, a lot of this was not necessarily intentional. Like, I was not intentionally only seeking out white men in the beginning, but kind of given the nature of, like, who has the funding or the amount of money to pay for sessions, and kind of depending on where I lived in North Carolina, it was really white areas. And so it was just happened to be that a lot of my clients were white men, and they were like, they were just really awful, you know, like you can kind of conceptualize racist North Carolina white men. And so there was one guy, actually this guy that I'm talking about was actually once I started doming in Chicago, and he was really nice and would talk a lot about, like, that he wasn't interacting with a lot of Black women. He, like, said some disparaging things about Black women and that he's interacted with in the past. Maybe he sought out other doms and situations like that. I actually read recently our initial conversations, and he said, I've had Black mistresses in the past, but a lot of them are often ghetto, quote unquote ghetto. And I like that you're educated. And I just remember, like, that was not the first time I heard those things, but really just a lot of eye rolling and like, oh, my gosh. And so he kept continually saying, like, problematic things and, like, not necessarily intentionally spewing a lot of, like, racist thoughts around Black women. And so, and he also had a lot of white guilt. It was like he was holding and juggling these two different dynamics at once. And so I was like, look, you need to be saved by our Lord and God, Audre Lorde.
Yes.
And like other people. So the first, so I gave him a reading, and I actually found it a few nights ago. It was a chapter from this book, like a chronicle called The Black Feminist Reader. And it was Patricia Hill Collins on the importance of Black feminist theory. That was the piece that I made him read. And I read his essay recently, and he was like, in the beginning, when I first was reading this, I thought that you wanted me to write an essay on my opinions of this. And it turns out, I don't think you actually care about my opinions on Black feminist theory, but you want me to learn about it. And it just gave me so much life. Like, he was on his knees at my feet reading his essay to me, and I'm, like, snapping the whole time, at least internally. You know, I have to keep up my persona of being very, like, cool. But in my mind, I'm like, yes, 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 read this. And it really just kind of stuck with me. I was like, I need to be doing this more. I need more white men at my feet reading me Black feminist theory.
Oh, my God. I love it. I love it.
Yeah, I do too. I wonder, can you talk a bit about okay, so I was watching Queer Eye, the new, you know, they revamped Queer Eye for the Straight Guys. So Netflix does that. And so today's episode I was watching, there was a black gay dude from Atlanta who was not
getting... I love that episode.
Yeah, so I'm halfway through, so don't give away the end just yet. But, you know, but he's a dude who's, like, really kind of clean-cut, business type, but he reveals that he's not out of the closet to like, his stepmother, for example, and his dad had passed away before he came out. But, you know, he's really clean-cut and really business-like, but then in his house, right, they go to his house, he's got, like, a harness and, like, a swing, and he's really, like, into, like, to leather, right? So I'm like, okay, well, what of, you know, this notion of I don't know what I'm. So talk a bit about what type of people you find to be into BDSM, because I think the people who are unfamiliar think that, like, they're all freaks, they're kinky, they've got some kind of problems, but they're everyday people who are into it, yeah. And do you think that there's a power dynamic? So the guy you mentioned, big, tall, built white dude, probably navigates the world with a lot of power, right? Like this black dude who's a business person. But so what do you make of the type of things that might lead someone to either enter and or enjoy BDSM?
So I love that episode of Queer Eye, and I love that in his closet he had those harnesses.
Yes,
I honestly wish that, like, some of my people were coming in with even that experience. A lot of people have, like, heard of 50 Shades of Grey or, like, have seen websites about, like, BDSM and kink, but they're, like, probably married or, like, have, like, you know, very private lives where they're not even able to go buy a harness, much less explore parts of themselves that they know are there, but they keep pushing down. And so a lot of my people reach out to me and they're like, I've been thinking about, you know, so maybe they're like 40 or 50 and they'll be like, I've been thinking about BDSM and submission for like 30 years and I have not had an outlet to do it. And it's like, these people, to be honest, I think I'm doing kind of the most vanilla BDSM in the sense that they don't know anything. I have to talk to them about, like, what BDSM means. These are all the different things that we can do together. What are you interested in? And they're like, I don't know. I just want to be humiliated. And so I wouldn't even say, in terms of the people that I am engaging with as a pro-dom, I wouldn't even say they're that kinky per se. I will say, the only thing I will say for the benefit of white men is that masculinity really impacts the way that all people, like patriarchy impacts the way that all people are able to like express their personhood. And so I see these men and they can't engage in the type of like sexual expression that they want to, which is often not even like literally sexual, you know, it's like maybe sexual energy, but like they don't get to like maybe wear panties or be submissive to a woman because those aren't scripts that are part of what masculinity is supposed to look like. And a lot of them are like, you know, there's like a reason why a lot of them are bosses and CEOs and are always saying like, I have a very powerful job. I don't have the space to explore my submissive side or side aspects of me that don't align with this kind of script that I'm now. I mean, they don't say it like that, but that's how I'm reading them, you know? And so I find that to be very interesting. And I think that maybe that resonates with me because I'm also experiencing the same stuff as a black woman. Like I'm supposed to be that quote unquote ghetto uneducated person. And I want to hold space for the different ways in which black femhood can be expressed. Like there is so much beauty in being ghetto. And also if you're not that, I don't want to be told that I'm white for being educated or that I'm trying to be like a man because I'm being educated. I just want to be myself as a black woman and be able to have that complexity. And so I see them trying to do that with themselves. And I'm like, I'm also trying to do that. Let's do this together. Let's hold these complexities together. And while we're doing that, you can pay me and then we'll be good.
Right, exactly. So it creates, the kink space creates for you and the client a true space of freedom, a private kind of revelry where y'all can be free in those ways. It makes complete sense to me. Tell us a little bit about the whiteness, right, of your clients. Like you mentioned, right, a moment ago around how your one client had worked with black doms before, but used the word like, oh, but she was too hood or, and I appreciate the fact that you're, you know, formally educated, so on and so forth. So what is it about, you know, because you talked about the masculinity and, right, this creates a freedom for them to go with their kind of illegible masculinities, right, to be submissive, to be passive. So what is it about them being, you know, white men in particular, and them wanting and requesting and paying for you, a black femme who's a black dom, right?
Right, yeah. So I think so the overarching, like, impetus of all of this is that in this kind of crass way, they are men looking to be, looking to be in the presence of power, and power for them means it's going to be happening, like, coming from a woman. And then I think a next level from that is that it's even weirder if that power also has blackness attached to it, right? Like, it's already kind of like bizarre that a woman would quote unquote be in power. And then the fact that it's a black woman, and then the fact that I am African and an immigrant and hold these other identities is like, they've never encountered this before, you know? And so I mean, it's something that I have like had a lot of like complicated feelings about. Like on one hand, I use those things to my advantage. Like I really up that I am an African immigrant. I mean, those are parts of my identity that I love. And it's so weird also sometimes to like that I'm using that to sell myself in this way, to like market myself as a person. And I know that these white men ultimately will come to me because they're fetishizing that. And a lot of them are like, I've never met an African woman before, you know? And they're already like, I already don't have a lot of colleagues that are black women. And then you're African? What? You know? On the other hand, once I get them in my presence, we can deconstruct some of those things. Like, these are the reasons why you came to me. Let's talk about why this is problematic, why this is racist. And you asked a question earlier about how do my clients respond to, like, having to read Black Feminist Theory. It's kind of like half and half. Some of them that really have this whole kind of their philosophy of white men being submissive to black women and like black femme supremacy are really into it. The challenge comes for those that like, you know, fetishize me or read me as exotic in those ways, but don't want to also challenge their own feelings of why I'm exotic in the first place. Those are the slaves that are really hard. And I have to use this black feminist theory kind of as punishment for them. Like if they don't, you know, if they like didn't do a task that I told them to do, like they didn't wash my dishes well, I'm like, all right, you got to write me an essay, read this and write an essay. And I kind of use it as punishment. And it's like kind of interesting. I think about that, the ways in which the roles in which the theory plays, it can be really liberating for some white men or a really exciting thing to do. Or for some of the white men, it could be really like, oh, she's on this again.
Mrs. Velvet, I wonder, this is probably the most important question I'm going to ask you. How did you get your name? And then can you help Kyla and I, if I was going to be a dom, help us figure out how we pick our, you know how they have those things like your stripper name is the first shoe you lived on and your color of your underwear.
Yeah.
How do we pick our names? How'd you get your name and how do we pick ours?
Okay, I picked my name because I bought some bougie lotion one day a couple years ago and was like putting lotion on thinking about what is going to be my name. And I was like, my skin is so beautiful as I was doing this. And I was like, maybe I want to pay homage to my skin. It's dark, it's smooth, you know, black don't crack. But then I was like, I didn't want to be something like chocolate, you know, that's like, those are the words that they describe me.
Yeah.
You know, you become this like weird foods, like, oh, I really love dark chocolate. I'm like, okay, I don't, but it has good antioxidants, whatever. And so I decided to, instead of thinking about what it looks like or what it tastes like, but what does my skin feel like?
Yes.
And I don't think I even really knew what velvet felt like, but I was like, I know that I want to describe my skin as velvet. And so that's kind of how I got my name.
Oh my goodness,
yes, velvety. I love that.
I love it. So, yes, Doc, so what we feel like, or what we taste like, or what we smell, and so what would our name be based on though? Can I look, Mistress? I'm the most vanilla person, at least when the lights are on.
Oh,
I'm the most
God.
Vanilla. We talk about it on the podcast, listeners. Y'all know I am vanilla.
Vanilla,
you know,
yes.
Well, you know, at least by day. Now, Doc, you know the true tea child when I go out of town, and you know, y'all know, child. But so I would be Mistress Vanilla? I don't know. What would I be?
I don't know.
You can, okay, so in terms of the first label, you can be Mistress or Domina or Lady. I've seen some of those.
Yes, Lady
or
Vanilla.
I kind of like when some of these more contemporary dominatrixes, they don't even have that like Mistress label at the beginning. They're just like, I'm Jade Sapphire and I'm here. And I'm like, yes, use this first and last name.
Okay, yes.
Oh my God.
Well, listeners, that's our challenge to you all, okay? And we'll send people something. I don't know. We'll send people a Strange Fruit t-shirt or something. But so
yeah, I would definitely be Afrikete.
Okay, yeah, okay. You'd be Mistress Afrikete or Lady Afrikete.
Yeah.
Listeners, send us a tweet or go on the Facebook page. And let me know, you know, Jay, this is your title, okay? So, and the best answer gets to win something. Mrs. Velvet, I tell you what, it has been a real delight talking to you. You are a ball of fun, and
you
really opened up my eyes. And perhaps
if I ever do get into the
business, maybe you can maybe teach me how to be a better. Once you pick my name first, we'll start there, and then maybe I can step my game up. So, for folks who want to perhaps either contact you for your services or want to read up on you, do you have a website or anything like that where people can reach out to you?
Yes, it's miss-velvet.com. Very easy.
All right. There you have it, listeners.
Thank you,
Mrs. Velvet, y'all. She's the dominatrix of the syllabus. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, listeners, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to poet, scholar, and activist Dr. Alexis Pauline Gumbs. Let's take a quick break. Doc, let the people know who we are.
You're listening to Strange Fruit by WFPL.
My third item is a VHS cassette.
This is a 1940 edition of Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None.
This is a piece of coral.
My third thing is a scar that I have on my neck.
Ragdoll that I was given by my mother when I turned 7.
5 things. It's like show and tell for grown-ups. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and don't miss a thing.
Welcome back. You're listening to Strange Fruit by WFPL.
All right, y'all. I mentioned it is the end of Black History Month, the beginning of Women's History Month. And so this episode today is all about phenomenal black women. And so now we want to have another conversation, Doc, with someone that you couldn't wait to have on the show today.
Yes.
There's a new book.
Yes. M Archive After the End of the World by Alexis Pauline Gumbs.
All right. Dr. Gumbs, welcome to the show. How are you?
Oh, I'm so happy to be with you all. I am Strange Fruit fan from afar.
Thank you.
And I just feel very honored to be part of this beautiful legacy you all are creating.
Oh, I love it. And we're such big fans of you.
Yes.
And your work.
Ever since back with the mobile home, like this was many years ago, the mobile homecoming project. And so we are so happy that the stars aligned in such a way that you can be on the show today.
Yes. And it's
thank you so much for having me.
And it's today the actual day, Alexis, that the book comes out, right?
It is. It is like the official release. You know what's beautiful, especially given, you know, who y'all are, is that the books actually got to the warehouse on Audre Lorde's birthday.
Yes.
Oh, that is so magical.
Like, yes.
Oh, praise the Lord.
L-O-R-D-E,
of course. Yes.
Of course.
Yes. So M Archive, right, is a part of folks are saying that it's actually going to be a trilogy, right? So first you have Spill from Duke University Press, and now we have M Archive. Is it a part of a trilogy, or do the M Archive and Spill work together in tandem?
You know, they, so I think of it as a triptych. So they do each really stand alone, but I made a decision at one time to write all three of them. And so I think of them together, although they're very different, but they do share a writing practice. So they come out of my daily writing practice. And what I decided to do was to focus on three of the theorists who I already obsess over and focus on in my work. And so Spill came from writing every day with phrases from the work of Hortense Spillers, and M Archive came from continuing to work every day, but with phrases from M. Jackie Alexander's book, Pedagogies of Crossing. And so the third one, the next one comes from working with phrases and especially moments of emphasis in Sylvia Winter's essays. So the process is something I decided on. Now, what would come out of it and what kind of things I would end up writing about, I had no idea. I just knew that I needed to write every day with those particular thinkers. That's just part of my own process.
Well, it is. I mean, both are beautifully, beautifully written. And I wanted to ask you about the thing that really stood out to me in the beginning of M Archive is when you say and with, when you're kind of calling on ancestral Black feminists as well as the Black feminists that are still with us. How important is it to you in your work to use not only Black feminist leaders, activists, you know, who are still with us here, and, you know, Black feminists who are in the ancestral realm?
Oh, it's the most important thing. It's the whole point for me. Yeah, we are. We're after and with Black feminism in so many ways. And so when I think about M Archive After the End of the World, it does imagine a post-apocalyptic looking back. But for me, it also has to do with being in a certain sense in a post-apocalyptic relationship to Black feminism in its earlier forms, right? And what does it mean to look back and say, okay, we're in a particular moment of Black feminism here, but we're, you know, the Combahee River Collective as an organization doesn't exist anymore. Or, you know, there are certain infrastructures that we are as researchers, and for me especially as a researcher, looking back at the material evidence of what they were dreaming about and thinking about myself in relationship to that. So sometimes I feel like I'm after the end of the world in that way. And to me, it's very important. I mean, you all know there is such a way that the work of Black feminist thinkers is not honored and cited to the extent that it should be. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I'm among the people who feel like there are, if people had just been listening to some of our foremothers, we wouldn't be in some of the very scary situations that we are politically, environmentally, and otherwise at this moment. And so for me, that's very important. I have a by every means necessary commitment that whatever forms I need to work in, from sidewalk chalk to, you know, to podcasts, to books, to literally everything, these words are going to be known, because I really do feel like Black feminists have been offering the information that can save our species and allow us to continue to live on this planet if we listen. Mm-hmm. And if not, you know, if not.
No, that's very true. I mean, and especially there's all kinds of triggering moments that happen for me as a Black feminist in this particular month. That's Women's History Month. You know, I'm really, really happy to see that there's so many Black blogs and things that are going on now, Black queer specifically, that are kind of honoring the legacy of contemporary and past Black feminists, and also the work of queer Black women, especially in this time of the month. But I just know that from undergrad, when I started getting into Black feminist theory, up until maybe a couple years ago, every time it was Women's History Month, it just seemed as if Black women hadn't done feminism. They didn't know about feminism. They were against feminism, right? And so learning about Black women being there from the very beginning, I mean, in the 1800s, way there, like that it is our legacy. I mean, at least the feminism that gets it right, okay? This month that tends to honor these, you know, kind of outdated and almost to me irrelevant in some ways, you know, white suffragist and so on and so forth. I think that your work is so timely, so necessary, and just so wondrous. And I think that, you know, in M Archive especially, the thing that I found really beautiful is this kind of calling on the possibility of scholarship, talking about the lines, these kind of lines that divide scholarship from politics or divide scholarship from art. And you see a cohesiveness with these things. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what you mean by bridging the gaps and the dividers between art and spirit and science and scholarship and Black feminism?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for me, I'm doing all of it for the same reason. So it doesn't make sense to divide, you know, myself from myself, right? So if my purpose is to love Black women and to really show the world how the love of Black women can give us everything, like the love of Black women is a real life vibranium, you know, that can actually solve all the world's problems if we accessed it and valued it as what it was. And for me, that comes in the form that it comes in, you know, which is every form. So I don't feel that there is any group of people who that's not valuable to. And I feel responsible for being creative enough that everyone can access it. And I do feel really proud about the fact that, you know, Hortense Spillers, M. Jackie Alexander, and Sylvia Winter are not necessarily writers who people outside of the academy have known about, you know, before now, which is fine because they've had a very specific mission and they have transformed the field of study and they have done incredible work, and they did the work that they wanted to do up to this point, and they're all still living and still doing amazing work. So that's wonderful. But I love the fact that when it comes to people talking to me about Spill and now starting to talk about M Archive, because a few people actually have it and have read it, and I know
yes,
you all
I have it. Yes,
checked it out. That, you know, they've said that they feel like they can access it at so many different points, you know, so to have like literally children in high school come talk to me about what Spill has done for them. And now they want to read Hortense Spillers, but they didn't feel that because they hadn't read Hortense Spillers yet, they couldn't engage what I was writing. That was very important to me because I'm a Black feminist, right? And Black feminists have showed us that you have to meet people where they are and open up to everyone's access. And what I say over and over again is like, absolutely, Black feminist theory is complicated, but it's not more complicated than our lives. You know, it's not more complicated than living as a Black woman, as a Black queer person that's complicated, right? Mm-hmm. So any of us who have had to understand ourselves and really create the narrative to understand ourselves in a larger story that doesn't even want to accept that we exist, we have what it takes to do any kind of nuanced reading. You know, like, absolutely, we have what it takes to analyze and to transform and to do any type of critical work. And I want that to be part of the message of what I'm doing, that, like, yes, you can understand it because you have had to learn inside of your spirit what works for you and what doesn't work for you, right? What's a yes and what's a no? What's safe and what's dangerous? We've had to do that to survive. And so I just, you know, I think that there's sometimes an underestimation of our communities at large, but there's just so much insight, precision, and nuance. And I feel like that's what I'm honoring. And at the same time, I want to, you know, there's the hashtag Fight Black Women, right? And so in the academic space where I do feel like many concepts that were created through the lives, struggles, sometimes literal blood and sweat and tears, and deaths of Black feminist thinkers, including Audre Lorde and June Jordan, and of course I can go on, I think that it's really important to do this exercise where it's like, well, what if I literally just cite one Black woman 150 times, 212 times, just like again and again and again and again. And I don't think that that then, you know, erases what has been lost from the absenting of Black women from the story of how we all are even here in this moment. But I do think that it's a reminder for those of us who care and those of us who know to go ahead and act like we know. You know, I can do it in a way that's repetitive, and I don't think it's excessive, but I think that it is also to make a point that there's enough complexity in the work of one Black woman to change your life, whoever you are, you know?
Yeah. Yes. Now, Dr. Gums, I know much of your work is based in Durham, North Carolina. Are you a native North Carolinian?
I was not born in North Carolina. So many amazing people were, right? Like Nina Simone. And I'm very proud to live in North Carolina. I was actually born in New Jersey, and I grew up in Atlanta. And I moved to Durham as an adult. And literally in 1 week was like, this is it. I never thought I would feel like monogamous about a city until I moved to Durham. And I was like, oh, this is the type of city where I may go somewhere else, but I will always come back. And I think that must have something to do with the indigenous histories and the incredible Black history that is part of Durham. But yeah, Durham is like, on that note,
so that's my question. To what degree, like, you know, me being, you know, Doc being from the North and me being a Southerner, like, I'm very, very proud to be a Southerner, right? And so I wonder in what ways, you are also someone who kind of migrated to North Carolina, to what degree has being a Southerner by transplant informed your work? As you mentioned, there is a large history of richness there in North Carolina, but I think about, and especially as it relates to even your Mobile Homecoming Project, like when we talk about documenting the experiences of Black queer people, you know, the South to me is extremely underrepresented, right? So we know about, you know, Marsha P. Johnson up in New York City, or we know about Sylvester, who, you know, we know about all these kind of Black queer people who either lived in the North or lived in major cities, and we kind of often forget or overlook Southern Black queer stories. So to what degree has being now a Southerner informed your work as a Black feminist, as a Black queer scholar, as a writer? In what ways is what made North Carolina home, not just literally, but also in your soul, if you get what I'm asking?
Absolutely. No, it's very key. Very key. Being in the U.S. South and its connections to the global South, I'm a person of also West Indian heritage, is very, very important to my entire approach. And I realize it when I'm not in the South and I'm like, oh, you know, certain things around like the centrality of food. I mean, you'll see that there's so much to the earth itself. You know, there's like people eating dirt, like all of these things are important to me, and they're part of. Being Southern is important to me in terms of a cosmology. And I think that it's a cosmology of understanding that we're related in particular ways, and that I know that I'm related to everyone, even people that I disagree with, even people that I feel shame of, you know, all of that. But that is, there's something that I understand to be Southern about that. Like, we're all eating from the same place. You know, like that is something that is very important, and lifting that up is important. And in fact, in Spill, it's interesting because in Spill, I feel like so many scenes in that book take place like on the porch and in the kitchen, you know, and mm-hmm. there's people there cooking a pot of greens, and it's not a coincidence, because that's so important to Hortense Spillers, being someone from Tennessee, and the phrases that were important to me that ended up being the sources for all of those scenes are the phrases where I hear her calling in that whole congregation. Right, like when she talks about getting up in somebody's face, and I'm like, wait a minute, this is a psychoanalytic theoretical essay, but she's just been getting up. I know where that came from, yes. Right? And understanding that as honoring the community that created her, and so then now doing this work that's inspired by M. Jackie Alexander, who's from Tobago, a very small island, and my folks are from Anguilla, also a very small island. There's a similar sense of like, oh no. We can't pretend that we're not related, right? What we need as a planet is to not pretend that we're not related, like that we can somehow pollute the same air that we're going to have to all breathe and then still breathe. That will never work, right? But if you live on a small island, it's very obvious. Like, there's nowhere you can put your trash that people aren't going to know you put your trash there. You know, there's mm-hmm. nothing that you can do and pretend that you're not making a direct impact on your community. And so I think that actually is part of what I saw reflected in Durham. When I moved to Durham, the way people gave me directions, the way if I had an idea and I said I was going to do it, people would just step to me in the grocery store and be like, remember you said you were going to do this thing yeah. for the kids, so my kids are going to be at your house at such and such time. You know, like you yeah. have to live your word in a particular way, and you can see your impact in a very direct way. And that's what I want for us. I feel like part of M Archive is the ceremony for us to see we are having an impact, and we are making certain worlds impossible through what we're doing right now. And we all have an accountability for that.
I love it. I love it.
No,
I love it.
Yes, yes. Tell us a little bit about how, because you also do this in Spill, but tell us in M Archive specifically how you deal with and work with this idea of spirit and memory in particular, and how those things for you are tied to a liberatory praxis, right? You say even mm-hmm. us breathing is an act of resistance. Like, just elaborate a little bit for our listeners on memory and spirit and how you see that tied to a liberatory praxis for folks.
Oh, yes, for sure. I mean, first of all, just honor to Jackie Alexander, because she is honoring spirit work as work. And she's honoring the fact that women of color all over the world are spiritual workers, right? And are doing work to bring spirit into the present. And often that work allows us to be connected beyond generations. It allows us to be connected beyond death. And it allows us to navigate oppressive situations in a way that understands that we are more than what the society says we are, and that more is possible than, you know, if it's a media narrative, if it's an interlocking space of institutional oppression that we're facing, to understand that that's also a crossroads and an opportunity, and that there's more that's possible there. So for me, I do see the work as a ceremony. And it's organized into these different archives that are of the elements, right? So there's the archive of dirt, archive of sky, archive of fire, archive of ocean. Mm-hmm. And it really is about understanding that there is an alchemy that's happening all of the time. We're participating in an alchemy, and it allows us to remember what we need to remember to be in this moment, even if we're remembering from a future place. So there's some time traveling that's for sure happening in M Archive. And for me, it's like, so that's complicated. You know, there's the periodic table of elements in addition to the four elements that show up in the book. But at the same time, it's also very simple, I believe, because it's just a question of what is it that allows me to remember myself beyond this body and beyond this lifetime? What is it, right? Mm. And it could be just a memory. It could be, I remember something that my grandmother said, right? Mm. And even though, understanding that even though my grandmother, if that grandmother has passed on, but I still have her words here with me, that means something about life, about energy and how it moves. And that can instruct me in how I go forward, right? What will be the words that I say that are remembered? What does that mean beyond my own physical life and my own survival in this lifetime? And that's something that is very, very Audre Lorde to me. You know, yes. When Audre Lorde
talks about the fact that this work began before I was born and it will continue after I leave, but my words will be there. Mm-hmm. That's a spiritual practice, right? Absolutely. But at the same time, that's an academic practice, right? That's the practice of the community of writers. I mean, I remember when I first read, speaking of being Southern, when I first read Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Are Watching God, and I was like a teenager in Atlanta, and I was sitting here reading this book, and I was like, wait, Zora Neale Hurston has been dead a long time. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, you know, I'm with Janie under the pear tree having all kinds of feelings. I got goosebumps all over my body. You know, I was just so with it.
Yes.
And I was like, but she's doing this to me. Like, this dead, long-hit, dead genius is doing this to me in this moment. And that was the moment where I was like, oh, so what it is for me to be a writer is about that practice. It is actually a spiritual practice, because it means that there's aliveness that is far beyond what I could physically touch, but it's possible through this tradition of writing.
It is indeed. It is indeed. Listeners, this has been Dr. Alexis Pauline Gomes. She's a poet, independent scholar, and activist. The new book, y'all, is called M-Archive, After the End of the World, and it's available on Duke University Press. Dr. Gomes, thank you so much for being here. It's good to finally have you here. We've been doing this show for almost 6 years. It's finally good to have you be on the show with us.
Yes, and I'm so excited. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I love y'all so much. Please keep doing what you're doing. It's so beautiful. It's so necessary, and it's a blessing to all of us.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well,
listeners, we are out of time, but it has been a full and fruitful show.
Yes.
Shout out to Mistress Velvet.
Yes, Mistress Velvet.
Shout out to Dr. Alexis Pauline Gomes, two phenomenal Black women doing such wonderful, wonderful stuff. And of course, salute another wonderful Black woman, you, my co-host, Happy Women's History Month.
Thank you.
Also doing some really good, some really, really good stuff. So, don't forget, listeners, the challenge that I issued earlier in the episode, I need my dominatrix name. Okay, we decided that you're Lady Africante.
But I don't want to be Lady.
Okay, do you want to be? What do you mean, Mistress? You want to be
What did Mistress Velva say? The Dom.
You could do Dom, like Dom Africante, but
no.
Yeah, no,
I just want to be Africante. Like, why?
Okay.
You know.
Well, you could just have like.
I mean, she said you could be like Lady J.
Like, you have like Madonna. Okay,
yes,
you have like
Africante, that's it.
Okay, Tyra, and then you got Africante.
Yes.
So you have your challenge, listeners. You need to let me know we'll pick a. Pick a wonderful name. You know, I need a backup career just in case this whole radio thing don't work out, child. I could go into BDSM. So we have a few shout outs to give this week before we go. As always, we love it when our listeners see us out and about, either at different events together or see us individually.
Yes.
Or show us some love on the internet. So who do you have?
We wanted to give a shout out to one of our Twitter followers who follows the Strange Fruit profile, who basically retweets and shares every single episode for the past several weeks.
Okay.
And we really, really appreciate you sharing those, you know, sharing our episodes all the time and shouting us out, I mean, periodically through the week. And so her Twitter handle is actually AskTND.
AskTND.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Because we do have some people, some super fruitcakes who are really, really engaging and always let us know their thoughts about the show and all that stuff. So that's really, really cool.
Yeah, thank y'all.
And we owe someone else another shout-out, y'all. We did our Moonlight Talk back at the University of Louisville a couple weeks ago. One of your students, Bailey's friends, came and said hello to us. And I promised her a shout-out, y'all, but y'all know I'm old. In my late 20s, I forgot. I am in my late 20s. Thank you. I forgot the young person's name, but I promise I will find out your name this week and give you a shout-out by name, because we always like to do that when we promise people that. So
yes.
We're out of time. We hope that you all will check out we encourage you all to check out the book M-Archive, and then also read more about Mistress Velvet and just figure out all the phenomenal stuff that they're both doing. So until next time, Doc, say goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye, everybody.
Strange Fruit is produced by Louisville Public Media. Our producer is Laura Ellis.
For more information, visit strangefruitpod.org, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at strangefruitpod.
The views expressed on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of LPM, its staff, or its underwriters.
Our executive producers are me, Jason Gardner.
And me, Kyla Story.
Thanks for listening.